We're talking about our government here.
No, we're talking about a crime, Bill, pure and simple. Y'all gotta start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white. Just maybe Oswald is exactly what he said he was. A patsy.
Dramatic. Well, yes, that was the 1991 film JFK from Oliver Stone. A fun romp, I guess, but just an orgy of every ridiculous JFK assassination conspiracy theory under the sun. Certainly those theories had persisted prior to 1991, but I think that really breathed a new life into the JFK conspiracy movement, and you know, it's something that persists to this day. Now, today does mark the 60th anniversary since the assassination, since that pivotal moment in American world history. So it was certainly a big moment for the United States, but also in modern conspiracy thinking. As CBS reporter Michael George explains, his conspiracy theories have persisted through the decades. And according to one historian, something that's been a part of modern U.S. culture.
The undisputed fact of November 22, 1963, was that America had lost its 35th president.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
CBS's Walter Cronkite broke the news to a shocked nation. John F. Kennedy had died after being shot in Dallas. But almost everything that followed became fodder for conspiracy theories.
There really is a before JFK's assassination and after, if you're looking at conspiracy thinking.
Dr. Jonathan Earle is the dean at LSU Ogden Honors College at Louisiana State University.
There's no single event connected with the assassination of President Kennedy that's not that people can all agree on. Everything is contested.
Earle says that while American conspiracy thinking dates back to colonial witch trials, Kennedy's assassination in the television era was a turning point.
Hundreds of millions of people watched President Kennedy's funeral, watched Lee Harvey Oswald get murdered on live television.
The sixth floor museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas makes it a mission to present the facts about JFK's time in Texas and his legacy.
It's an incredibly complicated piece of history. The world was thrown into chaos. We take the path of unfolding what happened, and you make your own meaning out of it. It's a way I think many people who don't appreciate history can find themselves in this really complicated story, and that it does still matter today.
A banner exhibit currently marks the president's motorcade route through Dallas that fateful day, presenting a tangible way for those piecing together history to follow its actual course. Michael George, CBS News.
Our next guest has written extensively about the JFK assassination and related conspiracy theories, including a book on the subject. He's also a lecturer in the humanities department at Champlain College, St. Lambert in Montreal. But has also authored a new paper coinciding with the anniversary of the assassination, a new paper for the Aristotle Foundation on how to use critical thinking to better assess whether a conspiracy theory might have some truth to it. So joining us to talk more about all of this is Michel Jean-Gagné. Michel, so great to have you with us here this afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here. And hello, Calgary.
So as we talk about the anniversary today, the 60th anniversary of such a consequential moment of the 20th century, to what extent was this assassination kind of the birth of maybe modern conspiracy theories?
Well, it depends what you mean by a modern conspiracy theory. There have been some before, but they tend to focus on outsiders, you know, Jews, Catholics, maybe secret societies. I think what changed in the 1960s is the focus of paranoia, maybe from the 50s, we could say, started turning inwards towards state institutions and particularly the American federal government, because a lot of conspiracy theories, you know, are American in nature, or their media is more visible than ours. So I think while there's always been this idea that there are groups plotting against us, whoever us is, the idea that this is happening from within the halls of government, an incumbent conspiracy, kind of became much more popular after the Cold War began.
You know, and the assassination is a good example of, you know, the idea that something so enormous, something so consequential, it just can't have a simple and straightforward explanation. Then there must be something equally as elaborate to explain something of this significance. Is that part of what lends to this kind of, you know, conspiracy thinking?
Yeah, a famous historian, William Manchester, once said that the problem with the Kennedy assassination is that this, I think he called him this wretched waif Oswald, doesn't seem to weigh against, you know, the heaviness of the most powerful man in the world at that time. You know, how do you equate these two things? You put the Nazis on one side and the Holocaust on the other, it kind of balances out.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of truth to be said that we want a story that, on the whole, seems to make sense. It seems to have proportion. And this story seems to lack proportionality when we say that an emotionally unstable young Marxist took his rifle to work one day and shot the most powerful man in the world.
And of course, just as, you know, as we mark the anniversary this year, we had a new book out recently from one of the Secret Service agents who was there that day that's maybe called into question some aspects of the story. But as you've looked at all of this and what we know about what happened, the shots, the nature of the injuries and the fatal shot, of course, to the president, does it still point to the direction of Lee Harvey Oswald's acting alone?
Very much so. You know, as the years go by, people's memories get worse, but the science gets better. And the more we are able to replicate gunfire and other things like that, the more we are able to see that the Warren Commission basically got the story right. There were maybe some things that they couldn't know with certainty, but they actually did a pretty good job. And maybe I could take this opportunity just to plug my own podcast. It's called Paranoid Planet, because this morning an episode came out where I'm interviewing one of the former members of the Warren Commission, retired Judge Bert Griffin. And Bert Griffin actually knows Paul Landis, the former Secret Service agent you mentioned. And he believes that Paul Landis is a very nice man, but because of trauma, because of the years that have passed, because of the influence of conspiracy books and publishers, he has kind of, I won't say manufactured, but he's lived in a false memory that over time has become maybe more real than the actual memories of the events that happened that day.
You know, and in terms of, and it gets to the paper you released this week as well, and in assessing these kinds of theories or claims, because when it comes to the JFK assassination, and maybe that's the gateway drug for a lot of people, because, you know, as we mentioned, you know, the enormity of it and, you know, this odd figure in Lee Harvey Oswald, but just the fact that, you know, we're in the midst of the Cold War and the fact that there's domestic tensions and others who might want to do harm to the president, there are a lot of kind of plausible endpoints for people to sort of say, okay, well, yeah, maybe there is something to this. So how does one go about assessing those kinds of claims? And I guess from there, you know, to assess other conspiracy theories.
Yeah, well, at first, I would say that definitely Kennedy was a life-changing moment for many. It's what we might call a flashbulb memory. I wasn't there at that time, but other people may have experienced maybe the death of Princess Diana in a very similar way.
Yeah.
For me, it was the shooting of Ronald Reagan when I was in grade three. It really kind of, I think that kind of jump-started me into the understanding that there's a political world out there. Now, how do we go about telling a true from a false conspiracy theory? You know, it could take years to research a particular theory in depth in order to become an expert. But fortunately, logic can help us debunk a lot of conspiracy theories without necessarily knowing the facts. We can see that there are either emotionally manipulative, or they force us into false dilemmas. You know, if it's not A, it must be B. No, the government either found a flying saucer or a weather balloon. If it wasn't a weather balloon, it must be a flying saucer, right? That's a typical ufologist argument about the Roswell incident. So what happens is that once we can identify some of those fallacies, those logical mistakes that you see a lot in conspiracy theories, or seeing that conspiracy theories tend to follow a script, a lot like a Hollywood film, then we can identify the things that are least likely to be true because they're titillating. They act as political propaganda. And at the end, they are trying to manipulate our feelings or our attention and not really delve deeply into what matters. For example, the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. How many books completely ignore Oswald to focus on some other theory, say, about the CIA?
Right.
But the Rosetta Stone of the Kennedy assassination is Lee Harvey Oswald. You understand the man, you understand why he did what he did.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life because, you know, Ronald Reagan survived. I imagine if he too had been assassinated, maybe would have seen, you know, the growth in conspiracy theories around that event, like what we saw with the JFK assassination. So it's almost like, you know, there is something to the magnitude of event and the likelihood that it is going to spawn conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to, I sometimes wonder that myself. It was only about 10 years later when I saw Oliver Stone's JFK that I kind of got sucked into that rabbit hole for almost 20 years, believing that the CIA had killed Kennedy. So these flashbulb memories have different types of power on us, depending on our vulnerability, our feelings of helplessness, and how confusing the story is. The big problem with Kennedy is there's so much information, it becomes a bit like a fractal. You never kind of get to the bottom of things because every historical event can actually become so broken down into little tiny factoids that it's hard to know when to stop. And that's the problem with Kennedy is there's too much information, pictures, videos, testimonies of people who were there, right? It was a public event. So when you have this overwhelming amount of evidence, it can go off in a whole bunch of different directions that often lose track of what's most important. Who was the person who shot the president and why? And can we actually trace the ballistic evidence to that person?
You know, and as you pointed in your article, I mean, you know, conspiracies do exist. I mean, the CIA has done some shady stuff over the years, and certainly in those Cold War years that would overlap with the Kennedy assassination. You know, Watergate's an example of a plot, a conspiracy that existed. I mean, as much as there are 9/11 conspiracy theories, I mean, the attack, the plot itself, you could call a conspiracy involving those who plotted and carried out the attack and hijacked those planes. So conspiracies do exist.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the great example that I use for a Canadian audience is the sponsorship scandal. You know, I'm in Montreal. I was here during the 1995 Quebec referendum, and the federal government tried to bribe or get some publicity companies to do more ads for the Canadian government, even though it was illegal under the referendum law. So whatever you think of the events that happened in Quebec in 1995, there was a conspiracy there, and it was unearthed by the Gomery Commission. But what we find out is that it's really hard to keep a secret. You know, when you're giving unmarked envelopes to people full of cash, they're not necessarily going to do what you want them to do with it. And it turns out a lot of these advertising companies spent the money on yachts or paying off their debts or whatever. They didn't actually do what the government wanted them to do with that money. So conspiracies in real life are kind of like that. The smaller they are, the more targeted they are, and the more kind of unsexy they are. You know, organized crime is pretty standard, you know, people being coaxed to give money so that their restaurant doesn't, you know, get torched or something like that, setting gas prices. These are not the types of conspiracies that you see in James Bond movies, for example. But conspiracy theories, the ones that tend to be very popular, QAnon, 9/11, Kennedy, they tend to resemble a movie script much more than they do real life history.
Right. And it's interesting because those tend to be American, you know, the conspiracy theories. I don't know if we should feel slighted as Canadians that we don't have any really good homegrown conspiracy theories. Maybe unsexy is the word, as you alluded to a couple of moments ago. Why is that, do you think? Why aren't there, you know, Canadian conspiracy theories?
I think historically we've had less because I teach political theory. So, you know, we're more Hobbesian than Lockean in our view of government. We kind of give the benefit of the doubt to governments more. But there have been some conspiracy theories coming out of Canada, you know, the Avro Arrow. Michelle Remembers, this book that claimed that there were countless amounts of Satanists abducting children.
Right.
That gave rise to the scare, the satanic panic of the 1980s. And, you know, I have to be cautious here, but a lot of the way that people have been talking about the trucker protest on one hand or the death of Aboriginal children on the other has a lot of conspiracy type reasoning behind it.
Very interesting. Your piece is mentioned up at aristotlefoundation.org. You've also got an article up today at thehub.ca exploring all of these issues and the JFK assassination in particular. Michelle, thank you so much for making some time for us here today. Really appreciate this.
Thanks, Rob. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back. Rob Breckenridge with you here on a busy Wednesday afternoon, obviously continuing to monitor this situation. The border crossing in Niagara Falls between Canada and the U.S., an explosion, a vehicle explosion on the Rainbow Bridge. connecting Ontario to New York. Now, in fact, we've got four border crossings in that area closed, including the busy one between Fort Erie and Buffalo. So some concern or some indication maybe there are some security implications here, a possible act of terrorism. Two individuals inside the vehicle are confirmed dead, the Associated Press has reported. So we'll continue to follow that. Now, meanwhile, big news out of the Middle East, where the Israeli cabinet has approved a deal that will see fighting paused and will see Israeli hostages, or at least 50 Israeli hostages, released. Global's Mike Armstrong has more.
Approval for this deal came overnight here in Israel. The final hurdle was political. It had to be approved by the Israeli government. The prime minister doesn't have the power to hand over prisoners himself. Now, in return for each hostage held by Hamas, Israel will hand over three people. It will be 50 hostages, women and children, for 150 Palestinians, women and teenagers. The fighting is supposed to be suspended for 4 days. That will allow for the exchange of prisoners, something that will happen in batches. The deal also calls for 300 aid trucks to be allowed into Gaza. Now, families of the hostages have mixed feelings this morning. No one knows who the 50 will be, and the painful waiting will continue. Camelia Ishe's 13-year-old granddaughter is believed to be held by Hamas.
I feel so disappointed because I don't know if my galley will be with this list.
Now, while the fighting should stop, both sides are making it very clear they'll be ready to pick up again as soon as the pause expires. A statement from Hamas this morning says they won't be taking their fingers off the trigger, while Israel's prime minister says his country is at war and will remain at war. Mike Armstrong, Global News, Jerusalem.
So quite a price to pay here, an opportunity that allows Hamas a chance to regroup and releases 150 Palestinian prisoners that have been convicted or in Israeli prisons. But it's obviously a priority for the Israeli public to get these hostages home. So joining us to talk about this deal, the implications, where this all goes from here, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Dr. Jonathan Chancer, Senior Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, FDD.org. Jonathan, thanks so much for making some time for us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be with you.
So how did it get to this point, the striking of this deal in your view?
Well, the Israelis made it clear that they wanted the hostages back from really the first day. And I think Hamas knows this. Israel has a history of making really painful trades. Mm-hmm. We saw this in 2011 after Hamas had taken one soldier hostage. They had held him for 5 years. The Israelis ultimately traded 1,000 Hamas prisoners for this one individual. His name is Gilad Shalit, and he's now back in Israel and living his life. But I think Hamas knew this, that when they were able to capture 240-some hostages, that this would be an opportunity to demand the release of some of its prisoners in Israeli jails, and that a hostage deal would be imminent.
Right, and that's the dilemma for the Israelis, isn't it? You sort of confirm that assumption, reward that strategy, but then at the same time, you got to get these hostages home if you can.
Right, and so the Israelis, I think, have been negotiating the entire time with the Qataris. They have been the interlocutor. It's really not exactly the most optimal interlocutor here because, of course, the Qataris have been sponsors of Hamas, and they've allowed Hamas to sustain a headquarters inside Qatar. But the Israelis have been working with them and through the United States. We've seen, the head of the CIA there. We've seen the head of the Mossad there. And so they've been working through this. There have been a couple of false starts over the last several weeks, but it appears that they finally lined everything up, and the Israeli government approved the deal last night, and I guess about 12 hours' time, we will begin to see the first movements.
Now, there's still going to be upwards, maybe over. I mean, we don't know the exact number, at least the exact number who are still alive, but there's going to be roughly 100 hostages that Hamas is still holding.
That's correct. And so what we're led to understand right now is that you're looking at about 50 to 80 hostages that qualify under the terms that Hamas has agreed to. So women and children, perhaps those that are sick or have bad injuries, we may see those people transferred. We, I think, are likely to also see all of the dual American citizens also moved back into Israel as a result of this deal. But the men who are of fighting age, so between 18 and 50, are likely to remain inside the Gaza Strip. Hamas also issued a statement yesterday that I found on Twitter suggesting that they only had control over 210 of the 240 hostages that are in the Gaza Strip. So this means that Palestinian Islamic Jihad or the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades or perhaps other terrorist organizations are holding the other hostages. And so it may be a challenge to figure out where they are or how to get them out. We also know, by the way, that the Israelis have been tracking the whereabouts of these hostages through their own means of intelligence. So they have a fairly good idea of who's there, who's alive, who's well, who's not. And so I think that also probably played a significant role in the negotiation. The Israelis wanted to get out those that really needed to get out more quickly.
We've seen in recent days the Israelis making some progress in, you know, capturing Hamas infrastructure. We've seen some new videos come out now that, you know, the Shifa hospital is under IDF control of the, you know, the extensive tunnel network underneath that hospital. So the Israelis have made progress for sure. But what are the implications now of this 4-day pause?
Well, the progress has, I think, been actually overwhelming. I think the Israelis have done incredibly well from what I'm watching. I mean, you can see the huge disparity in the fatalities, the killed in action. I mean, I think it's been less than 100 on the Israeli side, and it's been thousands on the Hamas side. You've seen the Israelis conquer large chunks of the military infrastructure in the northern Gaza Strip, which is where the organization really has, I'm going to say, maybe half of its military assets. You know, there are challenges that await. The Israelis will need to go into central Gaza and southern Gaza, the two towns there of Rafah and, well, there are actually more than two, but there are a handful there that are in the south that the Israelis are going to have to go to as well. And that, I think, this is all going to get slowed down because I think we can now say with some certainty that during these four, let's say, I mean, they're going to have a ceasefire for every 10 hostages that are released. So we could actually see 7 or 8 days of a ceasefire as opposed to 3 or 4, just really depending on who Hamas is willing to release. But for every day they buy, that is going to be a day where Hamas is going to be able to bring rockets out from underground. They are going to be able to fortify their positions in preparation for Israel's next incursions into the Gaza Strip. So the Israelis are going to lose the initiative here in central and southern Gaza. I think they are willing to do that because they're looking to save as many lives as possible. And that is really the contract that the Israeli people have with the state. Namely that soldiers, they're more than willing to allow soldiers to die to defend the country and to defend the people, but civilians should be off limits. And this is what the Israelis are trying to prove to the people. They want to win back the faith of the Israeli population. That's a lot of what's going on here right now.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll see how it all plays out in the days ahead. Much more is mentioned, fdd.org. Dr. Schatz, appreciate your insight on this. Thanks for joining us here this afternoon.
Anytime.
All the best. Jonathan Schatzer, Senior Vice President of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, FDD.org. Earlier today at the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, who's the UN or the Israeli ambassador to the UN, speaking during a Security Council meeting, again, making it clear that their goal to defeat, to dismantle Hamas has not ended, has not changed. As soon as the pause ends, we will continue pursuing our goals.
But make no mistake, as soon as the pause ends, we will continue striving towards our goals with full force. We will not stop until we eliminate all of Hamas's terror capabilities and ensure that they can no longer rule Gaza and threaten both Israeli civilians and the women and children of Gaza. The Palestinian representative cannot tell you that he doesn't want also Hamas to rule Gaza. I hope the Council takes the days of this pause to advance a real solution that will help bring an end to this war, that will guarantee security rather than strengthen the terrorists committed to Israel's annihilation. What would you do if your children were slaughtered and your girls were raped, but the UN and its vast spiderweb of agencies, bodies, and committees stood idly in silence?
Indeed. So the Israelis say they are going to continue this fight, but there's a priority here to get these hostages home, as many as possible. And it's quite a price that Israel is paying for this. And I assume then Hamas knew this going in. But again, it seems pretty clear the Israeli public has made it clear to their leaders that this needs to matter. This needs to be a priority. Now, the other domestic political factor you're going to start to see in the coming days is the backlash against Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, before all of this happened, there had been some massive protests in Israel after Benjamin Netanyahu and his government pursued these judicial reforms that many critics said was eroding Israeli democracy. And there was an enormous backlash against that. And obviously, with the attacks of October 7th and the war, you know, that's been put on hold and put on the side. But all of that opposition is still there. And organizers of this protest movement have made it clear that they're prepared to start again, maybe as early as next week. And now compounding that is the security failure of October 7th. And the broader failure of Netanyahu's entire political brand, you know, going back to as far back as 2008, 2009, as he's emerging as a political force in Israel, his whole message, his whole mantra has always been about, I will protect Israel from Hamas. I will be the one to end the threat of Hamas. I will be the one to take out Hamas. And he played that card over and over again. And so to go all of those years with a politician saying that, and then to have October 7th happen, I mean, that demolishes any credibility that he has on that front. And that's been his whole political brand. So, look, there's a war to deal with, and I think the Israeli public are focused on that. But there's a reckoning coming here. You know, there's an Israeli version of Saturday Night Live, like kind of a parody skit show this week. And they did this whole skit where Benjamin Netanyahu's in his office, and it's the ghost of Golda Meir that shows up and thanks him. Because now she won't be remembered as the Israeli prime minister who had the worst security failure on her watch, that being in 1973. And so that's pretty powerful in an Israeli context, that Benjamin Netanyahu would now be seen in that light.
We are taking this extraordinarily seriously, and Mr. Speaker, I will have to excuse myself now to go get further updates and work on this very serious situation.
So, yeah, that was the Prime Minister earlier this afternoon in the House of Commons commenting on this situation, the Rainbow Bridge, the crossing between Canada and the U.S. in Niagara Falls, an exploded vehicle on that bridge today. This is being treated, or at least investigated, as possible act of terrorism or attempted act of terrorism. The Associated Press is now reporting the two people inside that vehicle have been declared dead at the scene. But that investigation obviously continues. There are actually four border crossings between Canada and the U.S. in New York State that are all closed right now as this whole situation is investigated. The FBI leading up that investigation, it did take place on the U.S. side of this bridge. So we'll have the latest as that continues to unfold here this afternoon. Now, later in this hour, we are going to talk about this deal between Israel and Hamas, a deal that will see a pause in the conflict, the release of the hostages. And this was the Prime Minister a little bit earlier today commenting on that.
We talked at length about the situation in Gaza this morning on our G20 summit. The reality is this humanitarian pause is what Canada and others have been calling for weeks now. It is going to allow for hostages to finally be liberated It's going to allow for significant humanitarian aid to get into the civilians and the innocent people in Gaza who desperately need it. And it's going to allow for protecting of civilian life, including hopefully getting even more Canadians and foreign nationals out. This is an important bit of progress, but we have to redouble our efforts now to get towards a lasting peace.
Okay, so the Prime Minister says, you know, this is what Canada wanted to see, but let's not pretend that Canada had any role or influence in bringing that about. So there's a question here about our relevance. There's also a question here about our view of the world and how all of these things work and should be handled. You know, we've seen a lot of upheaval in recent months and in recent years. I mean, notably this conflict in the Middle East, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think from that, we've also seen a failure of official multilateralism. Where's the United Nations been on dealing with any of this? And I think Canada still, you know, has a foreign policy that's more or less been there for decades and a real reliance or belief on that system. So in the face of everything we've seen in recent years and the very different world we inhabit now, is it time for Canada to rethink all of this? Time for Canada to radically rethink its role in the world, is the case made, an interesting piece, co-authored by our next guest. You can find it at mcdonaldlaurier.ca. Jonathan Berkshire Miller is a senior fellow and director of foreign affairs, national defense, and national security at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Jonathan, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be on with you.
So let's talk about why now. And maybe this is something that's long overdue, but what do you see as the pressing case for a radical shift in Canada's foreign policy?
Well, I think, Rob, I mean, as you introduced, I think Canadians are still sometimes stuck in a mentality that dates back, you know, even 4 or 5 decades ago. You know, even if you think about, you know, probably the days when they used to have the Heritage commercials, and I remember there being one Heritage commercial that we used to have that talked about our role at peacekeeping. And right. It would highlight the situation, for example, in Syria, where you'd have UN peacekeepers and Canadian peacekeepers there at the time in between warring parties, and neither side had a gun, and there's this idea that Canada could come in and say certain things, and all of a sudden warring parties would go to their sides. I would argue we were never in that world in the 50s and 60s. We're clearly not in that world now. We see, obviously, a brutal war being waged in Europe by Russia and Ukraine. We see tensions in the Middle East. And I think the reality is that whether it's the United Nations or other multilateral institutions, that they're not a vaccine to every international problem. It's not to say they're relevant and have no utility, but I think this sort of knee-jerk reaction in Canada that a multilateral solution to every problem will be the way, I think we're realizing that there's big challenges with this assumption.
Well, I think there's a desire for Canada to be relevant globally, and maybe that's why we cling to this, because perhaps it's seen as a way in which we can, or a way in which in the past we have. So from Canada's perspective and how we approach these matters, how we set our foreign policy, like what's the guiding principle that we should be operating under here?
Well, I think on the first blush, I think we have to be intentional. So when states are intentional and they say, okay, this is what my interests, these are what my interests are, this is how I want to pursue them, then it becomes a bit easier. It's not, you know, you don't always achieve your objective. But I think the challenge for Canada is that we've even muddied this part up. I mean, what specifically are the interests that Canada cares the most about, and how do we go about achieving those? When we don't clarify those, and to give you sort of more examples of this, we don't really have a foreign policy strategy as far as a strategy document. We haven't had one in years. We don't have a defense strategy for 7 years, and now we've had a brutal war in Europe, which many of our allies have radically rethought their defense and security posture. We don't have a national security strategy either for several years. So, you know, how do you engage in the world when you don't have an up-to-date strategic blueprint on how to do that? So I think that's the, you know, the starting point. And then the second point is, I think, good foreign interactions and foreign policy that help Canadian interests and help Canadian prosperity starts with a bit of empathy and partnership. We just can't go around the world and basically saying what 20 or 30 people in Ottawa think, but we have to actually see what our partners need and want and try to meet them halfway. So this is, I think, it's been a glaring sort of deficit in our foreign policy in recent years.
Yeah, I think we've seen with sort of official multilateralism, if we call it that. I mean, you know, the UN, you know, seems to single out Israel for criticism. We've seen how Russia and China have used their position on the Security Council to really prevent any action, you know, be it on Ukraine or Taiwan or, you know, human rights abuses in either country. And so this is kind of the model that we're clinging to. But instead of multilateralism, your piece talks about the idea of mini-lateralism. Explain what that is.
So mini-lateralism is a form, again, not going alone, but countries like Canada as a middle power need to cling together with other states that share their interests. So when we say mini-lateralism, we think of a range of different countries. You know, of course, the United States is one of them, and we do things with the Americans, but it's not all about hinging off the United States. And, you know, some interesting examples would be in Asia, for example, doing things with like-minded democracies like Japan, in South Korea, of course, several in the European Union as well, and doing this in a like-minded group on specific issues that can have consequence. So rather than, for example, spending not only your hard-earned dollars, but your hard-earned resources on all of these multilateral institutions that have been handcuffed because of some of the reasons you already mentioned, why not spend those resources on these sort of mini-lateral groupings that can have very targeted and very impactful results?
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. It feels like our allies are already doing this, and we're kind of being left behind.
Absolutely. I mean, examples of this, obviously, you see it in Asia a lot with the quote-unquote Quad, which is a four-party arrangement with the United States, Australia, India, and Japan. You also see a sort of a hiving off of the so-called Five Eyes, which is an intelligence-sharing arrangement of Anglo countries since World War II, and Canada and New Zealand are now on the outside of that with the AUKUS grouping, which is Australia, the UK, and the United States. So you definitely see this. You see alignments happening within democracies, and I think we've been very slow to adapt.
Right. So it's not just about shifting foreign policy. I think we need to demonstrate that we're a reliable partner if we're going to be along for the ride on these kinds of initiatives. So what's needed here in terms of a shift at home?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I mean, often the excuses will be that the public doesn't demand a national security thinking or a strong principled diplomacy. I don't think that's frankly true. I think we've seen polling, for example, especially after after Russia's brutal war in Ukraine, that Canadians understand that the world is shifting and changing and that we need to do more. Even when it comes to, for example, defense spending, obviously we have a number of things that are challenging the economy now. We have inflation and so many problems. But Canadians still recognize that we need to do more. We need to do more on defense spending. And I would think on this, you talk about our credibility. We have an election coming in a year's time now in the United States. And Canada has been a laggard on defense and security issues for several decades. And for us to sort of sleepwalk into this 2024 with an election, very uncertain election happening in the United States, I think it could have huge consequences for our most consequential relationship.
Much more is mentioned, mcdonaldlaurier.ca. Jonathan, thanks so much for making some time for us here this afternoon. Appreciate this.
Thank you.
All the best. That's Jonathan Berkshire Miller, Senior Fellow, Director of Foreign Affairs, National Defense, National Security of the McDonnell Laurier Institute, co-author of this piece, calling on Canada to radically rethink its role in the world. And wanting to be relevant, wanting to be relevant for the right reasons, and wanting to make a difference. I think ultimately that's what we want our foreign policy to be. You know, standing on Canadian principles, standing shoulder to shoulder with others that believe and want the same thing. But are we getting any of that? You know, we put a lot of stock, a lot of faith in institutions that just aren't doing any of that. Welcome back. Rob Breckenridge with you. Our final hour here on a Wednesday afternoon. You can reach us 403-974-8255. We'll get back to more of your phone calls, a couple other things to get to as well. Today actually marks the kickoff of the Calgary Underground Film Festival. It's an interesting series of shorts being screened on Saturday under the category of Wild Man. More details at calgaryundergroundfilm.org. One of the films being shown, a documentary on, I guess, someone you might call a local celebrity in the Yukon. Some call him Crazy Bill. Most call him Caveman Bill. Bill Donaldson is his name. And for over 20 years, he has lived in a cave. Now, he's got a bed and some shelves and stuff. But, he lives in a cave. This is on the face of the Yukon River, just across from Dawson City. So the Ballad of Caveman Bill explores the life of Caveman Bill, Bill Donaldson, and maybe what we can kind of learn from him about our own relationship with nature. Joining us to talk more about this interesting story, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, David Curtis, director of the Ballads of Caveman Bill. David, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be here and be with your audience today.
Well, we appreciate you making some time for us. So how did you get onto this story then, first of all? How did you find out about Caveman Bill?
Well, I've lived in Dawson City for about 25 years now, and I've known Bill a long time. I'm actually a neighbor of his.
Oh, no kidding.
I live on an off-grid community on the other side of the river from Dawson City, and Bill's one of my neighbors and friends, and so that's how I know him.
Well, you would know him well then, I take it so.
I do.
What do people need to know about him then? What's that?
I know him even better now.
Yeah, I guess so. So for those of us who don't know him, what do we need to know about Bill?
Well, Bill is a person who has lived really sustainable and low-impact life for the really 27-plus years now in a hole in a cliffside across from the historic town of Dawson City on the traditional territories of the Trandoshan. And he's done that by choice. Mm-hmm. So that's something quite unique, I think, and it's something that I think audiences will find some real insights not only into Bill's life but and the area that we both live in here in the Yukon, but also I think some insights hopefully into their own lives.
Now, I mean, he's obviously, like, they haven't forced him to leave. I mean, he's been there, as you mentioned, for over 20 years. Like, he's allowed to live there? How does that work exactly?
Yeah, that's a really good question that comes up a fair bit. So the cave itself is not like a natural cave. It's a man-made hole in the wall that was done to do some exploration and try and find gold. There's still gold mining actively going on up here, of course. And this was done in the early 1900s. And the hole stayed there after somebody abandoned it without a bit of, some controversy around that. But it lies in an area that is actually considered part of the river. So the Yukon River, for those who don't know, flows through both Canada, through the Yukon, where the headwaters are, and all the way through Alaska to the Bering Sea. So it's a transboundary international body of water, which under Canadian law falls under the jurisdiction of the Coast Guard, it turns out.
Oh, really?
And... to the best of my knowledge. Now, I can't speak as a lawyer, an international or a law lawyer, national law lawyer, but Bill's place within that boundary sets him into this area of kind of no man's land.
Well, that's kind of fun.
And you'll see in the film, for those who have a chance to see it, but those who don't, Bill actually has to move out of his home once, if not twice, in a year because of the water level coming up and floods his cave. And so, that sort of gets, hopefully that answers your question.
Right. I don't imagine you see many Coast Guard officers, sailing down the river, patrolling Dawson City.
No, it's pretty much, we're on the edge of everything here and it's kind of every person for themselves kind of place and it's a little bit Wild West still, but I mean, it's not without its, of course, its rules and regulations, but Bill's the type of person though that he enjoys that about the town. I think it's one of the things that attracted him to coming here in the first place. He's a real free spirit. But also I don't think anybody would really care if Bill was there or not, because nobody else wants to move in. It's not like there's a that's part of the real estate boom that's going on in our community.
So the question becomes why, and this is kind of where maybe you see some interest for a broader story here, and what kind of sparked your own interest in making this documentary. But why does Bill live in a cave?
Well, it was a bit of a convenience for him when he first came up. He was living just in another area where a lot of people lived in this temporary tent city, it was called, summer workers, and he came up as a summer worker, an adventurer, and he's not a person who likes crowds, and so he heard word that there was this hole in the rock face upriver from this place, and he thought he'd go check it out, and he did. And so he thought, yeah, I could probably exist in here for a summer. And as he states in the film, he didn't plan to be here year-round, and but when it came to the fall, he decided to stay, put a tarp over the front of the cave, and 27 years later, here he is. So it was really just a question of convenience, I think, to a certain extent. But he continues to live that way because Bill is very low-key environmentalist person. Like, he's not on a soapbox out there, you know, campaigning or things like that, but he intentionally has lived his life since a very young age, actually, very conscious of the impacts of his choices in life. And so he wanted to try and live as low an impact of life as possible. And he still, to this day, like, he doesn't have a driver's license. He almost has never driven a car. He rides on his bike, which we go with him on some journeys with that. And he canoes mostly, for the most part, back and forth. He does have things like a chainsaw, but he cuts most of his firewood by hand with a handsaw. And he has a small generator when he needs it, but he uses solar power. He's a person that I've always, one of the reasons why I made the film was because I've always admired Bill's commitment to his values, his environmental values, and his love of nature. And he lives that out in a very real way. And I think that's a really amazing, probably lesson or example for the rest of the world right now when we're facing the climate crisis and the impact of our consumer society is having on our in our environment. And Bill kind of gives us an insight into a sort of extreme, I guess, level of sustainability and what that might look like. It's also kind of funny because there is a bit of a kind of prepper culture that really idolizes people like Bill.
Well, yeah.
But Bill's not a prepper. But I think as well it sort of points out some aspects of that world in terms of, you know, the notion of the end is coming, something that we need to be prepared, need to be self-sustaining. I think there's good aspects of that, but I think there's really negative aspects of that. But Bill, I think, embodies the positive aspects of that.
Right, because he is off the grid. Well, that's the thing. And when you hear people who are off the grid, right, it sort of speaks to that kind of prepper, those sorts of stereotypes. And Bill, I mean, fits that. He is off the grid, but for different reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's off the grid because it's a way in which he can live where he's not beholden to some of the conventions that the rest of us are, I guess,
yeah,
in terms of consumerist society and capitalist society. I mean, he says in the film, like, he lives off of between, you know, in a good year, he makes $14,000. And, you know, in a regular year, he can live off $6,000 to $8,000 a year. And so he shows us that, and he's happy. He's happy, and he actually lives a really fulfilling life. And that's, I think, the big part of the message of the film that I was trying to emphasize, is that Bill can do this. If Bill can do this and live with less and be this nice person and helpful and happy, maybe the rest of us could.
Interesting. Now, you know, he's known in town, right? I mean, you know, folks there know him, but this is sort of a different level of exposure. How did he feel about, you know, this project and being the center of something like this?
Yeah, well, Bill's actually a pretty social person. I mean, he's been featured on radio nationally. He's been featured in reality TV shows and spots or television magazine sort of type shows. So he's actually quite well known internationally. So for him, it wasn't really a big leap to do this. But what appealed to him, I think, was that I'm somebody who lives not as extreme as him, but I live similar. I live off grid and low impact, and share his values. And also, though, I came to him with the project on the basis that, Bill, I just want to sort of follow you for over four seasons or so, and see what your life is like, and make an observational documentary. So that's what we did. And he really appreciated that because I didn't ask him to redo things. I didn't ask him to do certain things.
Right.
So it's just sort of, it's also a bit of a betrayal of a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
He and I actually are, he said in an interview that he did with me, that our friendship actually, you know, got strengthened through this process. And it did. I can get a deep understanding of why Bill was the way he does. And he appreciated my approach to not wanting to interfere in our friendship in the making of the film, which can happen.
Yeah, he did not.
But yeah, it was a wonderful experience, actually, for both of us. I had a great time. I mean, I really kind of did it as it was a pandemic project for me. We made a little bubble, and I just was thinking of doing like a little 15, 20-minute piece on them, but it turned out to be actually something that we did over a year and a bit, and ended up with some, I think, solid enough footage and story to have it as a 51-minute film, and people are responding fantastically to that.
Well, as mentioned, folks can see it for themselves this Saturday, part of the Calgary Underground Film Festival. More details, calgaryundergroundfilm.org. David, thanks so much for making some time for us here today. Really do appreciate this.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks to all of your audience out there in Calgary, and to especially the people on the team at CUFF for programming the film and putting together such an incredible program on Saturday. Look forward to hearing what people think.
All right. All the best, David. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. David Curtis, director, The Ballad of Caveman Bill, part of the Calgary Underground Film Festival, which kicks off today again, calgaryundergroundfilm.org. And if you Google Caveman Bill in Dawson City, you can find pictures of, well, him. You know, he doesn't look like maybe the kind of crazy person some of this might paint him to be. He looks like a pretty normal guy. But you can find pictures of this cave that he lives in. You know, he's got a nice little setup in there. But yeah, I mean, it is a cave. So it's an interesting story. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.